Okay, so is everyone ready for our final meeting for the 10 common objections to Christianity? We're going to try to do it tonight. No guarantees, but we're going to try. Let me say from the outset that I really want you to make these answers your own. I want you to tweak them. I want you to add to them as you see fit. Make them your own. This is really just to help you get started in the process of thinking critically and just critical reflection when it comes to the questions that others might ask us about our faith. And so it's all about being obedient to 1 Peter 3:15. I'd like you to turn there with me. 1 Peter 3:15. Every apologist knows this verse by heart. In fact, that's where we get the term the apologist or apologia in the Greek is from this verse. It says in verse 15, "But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear." Be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you for the hope that is within you, the hope of the resurrection, the hope of Christianity, the hope of your faith. We must be ready to defend. Now, we said we're going to talk about evolution tonight, and we're going to talk about the problem of evil tonight. So we'll see how far we get. By show of hands, though, I have a question. By show of hands, who was taught evolution in high school? Evolution in high school. High school. All right. I was taught evolution in ninth grade, biology class. Who was taught evolution in college? Okay. I wasn't. I went to a Christian college. All right. Who was taught evolution in medical school? Just kidding. All right. It's there, though. Elementary school. Okay, there you go. Okay. It was, I tell you, it's everywhere. If you didn't get to raise your hand, I could just say, who's watched the movie that has had some reference to evolution in it? Everyone could raise their hand. Or who has seen some news report about the local, or the most recent find, you know, on everyone could raise their hand. So let's define our terms. Now, I'm using evolution in this sense, in the molecules to man sense, okay? In the goo to you via the zoo kind of sense, all right? So when I say evolution, that's what I'm referring to. Now, this is truly the atheists and the secular humanists' last straw. It's their last leg. It's their last excuse for not believing in the supernatural. If we take this away from them, they have no leg to stand on. And yes. And that's why this is such an emotional issue for these individuals. And they can become very defensive about this illustration. A few years ago, the church I previously served felt led to host a worldview conference as a follow-up to the movie Expelled. I don't know if you watched Expelled. You need to. It's great. But we did a follow-up to that, and we held the conference at Northwest Florida State College in the Panhandle. And our guest speaker was Nancy Piercy. She's authored many books, authored one with Chuck Colson, late, great Chuck Colson. But and she spoke on the topic of the logical implications of Darwinism. And we really, really promoted that event. It was heavily promoted. We had almost 800 people attend that event. But during that promotion time, we got a lot of positive and negative publicity, you can imagine. And one organization that really wanted to create a smear campaign for this conference was the Florida Citizens for Science. And I believe they're actually located, are based here in Central Florida. And these guys are very, very aggressive when it comes to evolution. Now, one good thing about them, they really try to support the teaching of science in schools, and I would too. But you know, their brand of science is not necessarily my brand of science. But anyway, at least I could say something good about these guys. But they're very aggressive in their adherence to this theory. And when I discovered their blog, which attacked our church, it attacked our conference, it attacked the Christian faith, I entered into an online dialogue with them, and things turned really ugly really fast. Here are some of their responses to my remarks. Quote, "I'd say that my worldview is far more plausible than sitting around waiting for a 2,000-year-old zombie to return." Here's another one. "We all become aware of what a dark age, witch-burning relic you are with the ideas that you are pushing. Your kind of faith is a degenerate disease." Here's another one. "It always amazes me, although I suppose it shouldn't, that people who believe in talking snakes, flying men, talking donkeys, giants, unicorns, 200-plus-year-old men, corpses coming back to life, 6,000-year-old universe, and innumerable other rational things written down in a book of Bronze Age goat herder stories can think that they have the truth, which trumps the whole of scientific knowledge based on real-world observation." That was written to me, okay, against me. And then finally, I like this one. "Don't you dare to presume I have no moral compass or emotions because I don't believe in an invisible man in the sky, you pretentious, arrogant nitwit." I really like that one. There are others that I could have put on here, but I don't think I could repeat them in the church. It got ugly really fast. Very defensive on this subject because this is all they have to rely on to erase God out of the universe. So I just want to be clear before we start, though. I'm not a biologist. I'm not, okay? I'm not a scientist. I'm approaching this issue as a theologian, as a philosopher. So if you have a very detailed scientific question, you're asking the wrong person, okay? I know just enough to get me in trouble. So we'll see how this turns out. But here's the issue. It is said that evolution disproves the Genesis account, and thus the rest of the Bible. Obviously, if we take Genesis 1, 2, and 3 literal, which I think we have to, if you ask any Hebrew scholar, they're going to side with a literalist, which that's what I am. I am an actual young earth creationist. I believe the earth is 6,000 years old. I make, you know, no apologies about it. But I take Genesis 1, 2, and 3 very seriously and very literally as any Hebrew scholar would. So if evolution is true, then Genesis 1, 2, and 3 cannot be true. It just can't. This is not compatible. Now, let's just look at evolution itself. It is not a plausible theory that can explain the origin of life. Okay? It's built around mutations and natural selection. Mutations and natural selection. That's the driving mechanism, supposedly, behind evolution. Now, mutations are just genetic copy and mistakes. They do happen. When they do happen, there are problems. Mutations cause a loss of useful genetic information. They are harmful in almost every case, and when they are not, they're merely neutral in effect. Now, some people will say there are beneficial mutations, for example, wingless beetles. The only way that's beneficial is the wingless beetle on a windy island, right? Because he's lost information that codes for wings. Get that? He lost information that codes for wings. Now he can't be blown out into the sea and die. Well, that's beneficial for him, but it still was the result of a loss of information in the genetic code. There was no increase of information, which is what you would have in order for evolution to happen. So what you would have to have is, in a mutation, you would have to have this mutation happen, which would create never before present useful information that actually coded and resulted in a new physiological structure that gave this creature an immediate survival advantage. Okay? You can't just have a mutation that's building up to some physiological structure, that would be a transitional form. And the transitional form could not survive. It would have no survival advantage in nature. In fact, it would have a disadvantage. Let me show you what I mean. Consider the giraffe, okay? Now, the giraffe heart is probably the most powerful in the animal kingdom. It actually weighs about 25 pounds. It has to be heavy-duty industrial because you think about all the blood that is being pumped up this animal's long neck, right? Now, we have a problem because the brain is a very delicate structure. And you have this powerful heart pumping lots of blood, and then the giraffe lowers its neck. What happens? You have this immediate rush of blood, right? Now, why doesn't the giraffe blow his mind, right? That's the question. Why does that not result in an explosion? Well, thankfully, there's a couple of design features in the giraffe that help control this. First, in the jugular veins, there's a series of one-way check valves which immediately close as the head is lowered, and that basically prevents this backflow of blood into the brain. Now, just imagine for a moment if these check valves were in transitional stages. Maybe just a little bit of a piece of skin. What's going to happen? The blood's going to. So that's not going to work. There's no survival advantage for the giraffe. There's a disadvantage. It's going to wipe out the giraffe guy. Look at this other question. What about the blood flow from the carotid artery from the heart to the brain? Well, there's this other design feature that we call the Wonder Net. It's a spongy tissue-filled spongy tissue that's filled with numerous small blood vessels. It's located near the base of the brain, and the arterial blood first flows through this net of vessels before it reaches the brain. Now, let's think for a moment. If this spongy tissue was only in a transitional form, it wasn't fully coated yet, and the giraffe bent over, lowered his neck, there's nothing there to stop that blood flow, and the brain is done. So we would have no giraffes. Do you see the transitional forms? That's not going to work. And you would have to have a series of related mutations, innumerable mutations that would code for something that complex. And you would have to have them at once. So we have this major problem already. Now, let's go back to mutations. Let's look at an illustration here. Now, if we look at a wolf, and in fact, even secular scientists would say that if you look at the genetic code for a dog, it could be traced back to one kind, which is the wolf. The wolf has, put it simply, the wolf has all the genetic soup to create the different types of dogs that we see. And so through mutation, through natural selection, and through what we call artificial selection, which is where we actually breed animals to get particular mutations. Who has a poodle in here? Anyone have a poodle? Oh, good. I won't offend anybody tonight. I'll tell you. Yeah. I tell you, the poodle is the most mutated dog in existence. It's terrible, even worse than a chihuahua. But as you can see, through mutation, through natural selection, and through artificial selection, as we go down, it's all a decrease in information as a result of these mutations. In other words, you can't take a poodle and breed back up to a wolf because that information has been lost in the genetic code. You can never do it. You can't get back to a wolf from a poodle, from a chihuahua. Now, you can take a wolf, and through process of mutation and natural selection, artificial selection, you can create these different types of dogs, but you can't go back up. So see, mutations are heading in the wrong direction. We need increase of information. This is setting down, not up. Now, by the way, this is interesting too. Here's all of the genetic problems that are a result of mutations in the poodle. That's why they're very expensive to own. You basically have to take out a healthcare package for them because, I know you can't see this very well, but there's so many, I couldn't get them all in one. That's all the result of mutation. They're harmful. They're not helpful. They don't increase information. They destroy useful information. Cancer is a result of a mutation. You just can't get evolution to happen through this mechanism of mutation. It's not going to happen. Now, let's talk about natural selection for a moment. Now, natural selection is not evolution. A lot of people try to equate it with that, and even evolutionists will say, well, it's one of the driving mechanisms of evolution. It's not. It has nothing to do with evolution. We'll see from this example. If you took, say, a dog that had genes coding for long and short fur, okay, so this would be like a middle, medium-length fur. Now, from these two dogs, you could get genes coding for only short fur, long and short fur, or only long fur, okay? But if you, for example, if you had the dogs who only had the genes that coded for long fur, that's all you can get from them, okay? Same thing with dogs with only short fur. Now, let's say we took a group of dogs. Let's say we took a group of dogs which had a genetic code only for short hair and only for long hair, and we took them to Antarctica. And we dropped them off and said, see ya. We observed them for a time. Guess which one dies first? Guess which one keeps reproducing? Now, in that population, we've lost information for what? Short hair. Is that evolution? No. Is there loss of information? Yes. That's not evolution. Okay. In fact, you could think about if we had two dogs, say the wolf variety, say from the ark, and they went out, they reproduced and reproduced and reproduced. Again, they carry the genes for long and short fur. They have the genetic soup for everything. And they went out, and then these dogs began to split up and go to different areas. Now, based on what they had the codes for, genetic codes, or what temperature, climate they entered into, that's going to affect which survive, which do not. And that's going to basically create what we see in terms of long hair, short hair only. What do we see? What survives? Natural selection is not evolution. It's actually something that's built into the genetic structure that God created. It's just basic genetics and an environment. That's all it is. So there are no driving mechanisms for evolution. We can see that. Now here's the real, real bottom line. Right here, the fossil record. I mean, let's face it, if evolution has been occurring for millions and millions and millions of years, we should have record of this in the geological history of the Earth, right? Check this out. There are no transitional forms in the fossil record. No, not one. I don't care what museum you go to that claims that there is one. There's not. There are no transitional forms. In fact, most of the fossils that we find, let's say this one on the top here, is a fish eating another fish. It was immediately fossilized. Okay. Now, we're leaving the whole issue of transitional forms now, and we're going into the whole question of how long does it take fossils to form? Well, you see here, this fish was fossilized while it was having dinner. Okay? It didn't take millions of years for this to happen. It happened immediately. And this points to something catastrophic. We have lots of water, lots of sediment, lots of mineralization to get a fossil like this. And by the way, it doesn't take that long. I don't have the pictures here, but we found fossilized hats and mines. We've found fossilized ham before, which was in a volcanic episode. But here in the bottom, we have an ichthyosaur, okay? It was fossilized while giving birth. An ichthyosaur was a marine reptile, actually born live. And you can see the baby ichthyosaur right here being born and immediately fossilized. Not millions of years there, but just a moment. Now, the picture in the top right is what we call a polystrate fossil. And a polystrate fossil is a fossil that basically covers more than one geological column. So supposedly these columns represent millions of years, but this is a fossilized piece of tree trunk that is traversing what should be millions of years of layers. Now, how could that be? It can't. If we suppose millions of years, I mean, it wouldn't take even 500,000 years for that tree to rot. There would be no evidence of this tree in the record if that's the case. This was done really fast. These layers were put down really fast, not over millions of years. So the fossil record is very interesting. It really does cause evolutionists a lot of frustration. It's the best evidence, really, against evolution in that sense. But there you go. I mean, actually, I think most fossils point to a worldwide flood. I mean, what could create lots of water and lots of sediment and lots of pressure all at once? A worldwide flood. Right, and, you know, creationists who study barmanology, which is the created kinds, okay, the dog kind, the giraffe kind, elephant kind, or whatever, we look at this and cause these original created animals, kinds, had the genetic soup to make the varieties we see today. Yes, that variation was something that God intended to happen. Yes, there's nothing wrong with that. It was intended to happen. We can, you know, think about this. Even Adam and Eve, like, we think about the races, okay? Think about the races. Think about this for a moment. Just skin color, okay? I'm not even talking about physiological, you know, facial features, that kind of thing. Just skin color. If Adam and Eve, say, were a middle brown in skin tone, and they had the genetics for that, they would have the genetic soup to create every variety of skin color from white to black. And that's what we think happened. If you go to the Creation Museum, which is part of Answers in Genesis in Kentucky, you'll see that they have a replica of Adam and Eve, and they're exactly middle brown in color for that reason. It's a very interesting thought. Well, you know, talking about genetic code, not only do you need the code, but you need a code interpretation device. And you have to have both at the same time. You know, the genetic code, DNA, is basically like Morse code almost, and it's built around like basically like four letters, so to speak, in the code. So not only do you have to have the code, but you have to have something to interpret the code. It's almost like one of the little music boxes, if you will. You know what I'm talking about? The ones you wind up, and it has a little metal bar, and it has little bumps on it, and as it scrolls, it makes music. That's really kind of what the DNA code is like. But something has to read it. Now, tell me this. How did the code originate, and how did a code interpretation device originate at the same time? That's part of the intelligent design argument. You see what I'm saying? It's kind of like having software and needing a computer to run it. Now, how did they both come to be so that they could integrate? Because the intelligent mind put it together, okay, and created it. All right, so, yes, did I answer your question? Okay, all right. Anything else? That's really our time for tonight, actually. Let me throw one more thing out there. This won't take very long, but this will leave just one question for next time. But this is a freebie. This is what I call epistemological skepticism. In other words, there are people out there who say that there's no truth, that we can't know truth, that there are no absolutes. And we're going to go through a little exercise now to help you deal with some of that stuff. Let me go through this, see some of my future slides for next question. All right, yes, the truth is out there, all right? Now, this is really, really interesting because a lot of college students are facing this whole issue of being told there's no truth, that there are no absolutes. And what they need to do is to march straight to the administration office and say, look, I want my money back. If there's no truth, then what am I paying you for? What am I here for? There is truth. Now, we commonly hear it said like this, truth does not exist. There is no such thing as truth. How would we respond to that?
Is that true?
Is this true about truth? Now, it sounds like we're playing word games, right? But we're not. Because with logic, that's how way things work. Okay? I mean, we're applying logic to the issue. And it shows we're not playing word games. I mean, this is the way reality works. I mean, there you go. Truth cannot be known. We cannot know truth. How would we respond? Okay, right. What does this represent then? Yes. We could say, is this true about truth? So you can know that this is true. Ah, see. You can know this is true. I see. So you can know something about truth. All truth is relative. We've heard this a lot in our culture. All truth is relative. What can we say? Let me give you a little hint here. What you want to do is simply turn the table on the statement by holding it to its own affirmation, okay? Just hold it to its own affirmation, and it will self-destruct. These are self-refuting, self-defeating statements. Is this a relative truth? See? We're just holding the statement to its own affirmation. What about this one? What is true for you might not be true for me. How would we tackle that one? What is true for you might not be true for me. Yeah, I can't remember the philosopher or who it was who said this, but he said, if any man would argue with me, let him first define his terms. I can't remember who that was who said that, but it stuck in my mind. By the way, what is truth? Truth is reality. Truth is reality. That's what it is. Now, we may be delusional and not be able to perceive truth, but truth is reality. Whatever reality is, that's the truth. Okay? Now, they're basically trying to get at, can we know then reality? Can we have an accurate perception of reality? Now, that gets into epistemology, which is the study of how we come to know things and how we know what we know and those kinds of things. But most people will not be equipped to really go into epistemology with you, so you don't have to worry about that one too much. But is this true for everybody? See, if it's true for everybody, then you've defeated your own statement, you've destroyed yourself. It's a reductio ad absurdum. It reduces to absurdity. We can't know anything for sure.
So 2 plus 2 is not 4?
I mean,
like,
yes.
I know that for sure.
Yes. You know, it's basically logic, but...
I have 2
Right. See, here's reality. There you go. We can't know anything for sure. You know, I mean, those kind of people are the kind of people that would say, well, would 2 plus 2 equals 4 be true on the moon? Would it be true in this part of the universe? Would it be true? That's the way they're thinking. Right, right. Can't know anything for sure. Are you sure about this? That will take care of that one. There is no absolute truth.
Are you absolutely sure?
Is this statement absolutely true? Do I have any more? Yeah, there are no absolutes. Very similar statement. There are no absolutes. Is this absolute? Right. Are you absolutely sure? Good. So you can see how this would work. It's simply applying logic, holding the statement to its own affirmation. These people, you say there is no truth, but basically speaking a truth. I mean, if that's reality, then there is truth. There's no way to get away from it. Truth is. There's no way to escape it. Okay, if you say there's no truth, then that's true. There's no way to get away from it.
They're creating their own
truth. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're making a statement about truth, and it's either accurate or it's not, you know. But there's truth. So anyway, that's just something that I wanted to take you through, because we do hear a lot of that stuff in our day, and it's irrational. Sometimes when you talk to these people, you know, you can't get anywhere with them because they're not rational. They, you know, I mean, okay, yes, you know, there's nothing left for us to do. There's no reason for me to argue with you. If you're not rational, then. So anyway, we're going to look at the problem of evil next Wednesday. That'll be the final one. It's the most emotionally charged issue. It's the most difficult issue that we might face in a conversation, or if we're the global world outreach program we've been talking about, maybe someone writes to you and asks you about that. So this is something that we need to be able to answer. By the way, just talking about evolution real quick. Really, this whole theory is really the most diametrically opposed to our faith. It's worse than Satanism, okay? Because Satanism acknowledges the supernatural, acknowledges that there's a God, acknowledges that there are demons. They're saying evolution, Darwinism, or philosophical naturalism, these are all the same terms for the same thing. Basically says there's nothing but nature. There's nothing but atoms, nothing but matter. This is completely diametrically opposed to all that we believe.